Hey there, deep divers. Welcome back. Today we're going to be tackling a question
This is a good
that
one.
you probably haven't thought much about before.
Yeah.
Whose job is it to say whether the U.S. officially recognizes another country?
Exactly.
It sounds simple,
I
right?
mean, think so.
But as you'll see, it can get surprisingly tricky,
Oh, yeah.
especially when it comes to the heart of the
It's
Middle East, Jerusalem.
a good one.
So,
This question about recognition landed right on the steps of the Supreme Court.
exactly. And it all started with an American citizen,
Okay.
Menachem Binyamin Zivotofsky,
Zivotofsky.
who's born in Jerusalem. Now he wants his passport to list Israel as his birthplace.
Right.
Makes sense on the surface,
Seems straightforward.
but the U.S. has this long-standing policy
Yes.
of not recognizing Israeli sovereignty over Jerusalem.
This is where it gets really interesting.
It does.
That passport request turned into a huge legal battle, Zivotofsky v. Kerry, which went all the way to the highest court in the land.
So before we get into all of the Supreme Court drama,
Sure.
can you help us just understand
Absolutely.
what recognition actually means in international law?
Yeah.
It's more than just a friendly wave, isn't it?
It's a huge deal. Think of it like this. Imagine a new kid shows up at school. Recognition is like the principal saying, yep, this student is officially part of our school. They have all the rights and responsibilities of any other student. So in the world of nations, that means things like diplomatic relations, treaty negotiations, even whether you can sue in US courts.
So it's about legitimacy
It's about legitimacy
on the world stage.
on the world stage.
Okay, so how does a country actually do recognition?
How do they do recognition?
Is there a ceremony?
Well, sometimes it's very formal, like signing a treaty. Other times it's implied, like when countries start exchanging ambassadors. Think back to that school analogy. It's like when other students start inviting the new kid to their lunch table.
I like that. Very good.
Yeah.
But where does the president fit into all of this?
Well, that's where the Constitution comes in, specifically Article 2, Section 3, the reception clause. It says the president receives ambassadors. Some argue this means the president has inherent power when it comes to recognizing other
So
countries.
you receive an ambassador. You're essentially saying,
Right.
welcome, your country is legit in our eyes.
Right.
Seems straightforward enough.
Hold on. There's a catch. Some argue the reception clause is merely ceremonial. They say it's more like the principal introducing the new student at an assembly, a formality, not the deciding factor in their enrollment.
I see the conflict brewing.
Exactly.
So it's not crystal clear
Right.
whether the president has the final word
Not at all.
on who we recognize.
It's a big debate.
But why doesn't Congress have a say in foreign policy too?
Of course they do.
They can't just sit on the sidelines while the president calls all the shots, right?
You're absolutely right. Congress has some serious power in foreign affairs, spelled out in Article 1, Section 8 of the Constitution. Think regulating commerce with other nations, declaring war, raising armies, all pretty influential stuff.
Right. So even if Congress can't directly dictate who the president recognizes, they can definitely make things easier or harder
Absolutely.
for those relationships to flourish.
For sure.
Checks and balances in action.
Exactly. They can pass laws that affect our relations with specific countries, even if they can't control that initial you're in the club moment of recognition.
So let's circle back to Mr. Zivotofsky and his passport request.
Okay.
He's caught in the middle of this constitutional tug of war.
He is.
So walk us through the specifics of his case
Sure.
and how it ended up in the Supreme Court.
So Zivotofsky's parents, wanting his birthplace listed as Israel, cited a 2002 law allowing this, but the State Department, sticking to U.S. policy, refused and offered Jerusalem instead.
That makes sense, given what we've just talked about the sensitivity of recognizing Jerusalem as part of
Yes,
Israel.
exactly.
So how did this passport standoff become a Supreme Court case?
Well, the family didn't give up. They argued that the 2002 law was a direct order for the State Department to list Israel on passports, and the president couldn't ignore that.
So it became a question of
It became a question of whether Congress could force the president's hand on a matter of recognition, even through something as seemingly simple as a passport.
Yeah, so it's not really about where Zivotofsky was born.
Right.
It's about who gets to decide what
Exactly.
that passport says,
It's much bigger.
which, as we've seen, has much bigger implications.
Absolutely.
So what did the Supreme Court ultimately decide?
In a 6-3 decision, the Supreme Court sided with the president. They said the president has exclusive power over recognizing foreign nations and that Congress can't use a passport to contradict the president's stance.
Wow, that's a big win for the executive branch.
It is.
What was their reasoning behind that decision?
The court stressed the need for a unified national voice in foreign policy.
Okay.
Especially when it comes to something as delicate as recognizing another country.
Right.
They argued that the president, as the head of state, is uniquely positioned for diplomatic negotiations and making these tough calls.
I can see how having Congress dictate the president's stance on recognition through something like a passport could create chaos and confusion on the world stage.
Absolutely.
It wouldn't exactly project strength and unity, would it?
That's precisely their point.
Okay.
They saw passports as official communication, potentially impacting recognition and therefore falling under the president's authority.
Okay, so it's not just about where someone was born.
Right.
But the symbolic weight a passport carries on the international stage.
Exactly.
But I'm betting not everyone on the court was happy with this decision, right?
Oh, of course not.
There had to be some dissenting voices.
There were some strong opinions from the justices who disagreed.
Okay.
And those dissenting opinions are crucial to understanding the full picture.
That's what makes this deep dive so fascinating.
I agree.
It's not a simple yes or no answer.
Nope.
So let's explore those dissenting voices in part two.
Sounds good.
Because they offer valuable insights into this ongoing debate about presidential power in foreign affairs.
Okay.
Welcome back, Deep Divers. We're picking up our conversation about the Zivotofsky v. Kerry case.
Right.
Where the Supreme Court affirmed the president's power over recognizing foreign nations. But as we hinted at before,
yes,
not all the justices were on board.
Not at all.
With this decision.
Right. And those dissenting voices are critical to understanding the nuances of this debate.
Okay.
It's not just about agreeing or disagreeing.
Mm-hmm.
It's about exploring different interpretations of the Constitution and their potential consequences.
Exactly. So let's dive into those dissenting opinions.
Okay.
First up, we have Justice Breyer, who threw a curveball.
He did.
By calling this whole passport issue a political question.
Right.
What did he mean by that?
Well, Justice Breyer believed that this case was tangled up in complex political considerations that were better left to the president and Congress to sort out. He felt the court shouldn't wade into these murky waters because it could have unintended consequences for diplomacy.
So it's like he's saying this is a political hot potato.
Right.
And we, the court, don't want to get burned.
Exactly.
He's advocating for judicial restraint.
Yes.
Recognizing the limits of the court's power.
Exactly. He acknowledged that the issue of recognition is inherently political and that the court should tread carefully when dealing with matters that could impact foreign relations.
Interesting. So while he didn't explicitly say whether he agreed with the president's power over recognition, he felt it wasn't the court's place to overrule the executive branch on this particular issue.
Exactly.
Okay, now let's move on to Justice Thomas, who, as always, brought a unique perspective to the table.
Justice Thomas, always fascinating.
He drew a distinction between passport regulations and consular reports of birth abroad.
Interesting.
Adding another layer to the debate.
It is.
Okay, this sounds pretty technical.
It can be.
Can you help us break it down?
Sure.
What's the difference between those two documents?
Yeah.
And why did it matter to Justice Thomas?
So imagine this. You're born overseas.
Okay.
And your parents want to register your birth with the U.S. Embassy. That's where a consular report comes in.
Okay.
It's basically a record of your birth abroad for citizenship purposes.
Okay.
A passport, on the other hand, is your ticket to travel internationally.
Okay. So Justice Thomas agreed with the majority.
Yes, he did.
That the president has the final say on passports. Seeing them as an extension of the president's foreign affairs powers.
Right.
Okay, that makes sense. But why did he see consular reports differently?
He argued that consular reports, unlike passports, fall under Congress's power to establish rules for naturalization.
Okay.
Which is specifically mentioned in the Constitution.
Uh-huh.
Think of it this way. A consular report is primarily about documenting citizenship.
Okay.
Something Congress has clear authority over.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas a passport is about international relations, where the president plays a more prominent role.
So Justice Thomas is saying the Constitution gives Congress the power to determine who's a U.S. citizen.
That's right.
And consular reports are a key part of that process.
Exactly.
It's a subtle distinction.
It is.
But an important one in terms of who controls those documents.
Precisely. And that's what makes his dissent so interesting.
Okay.
It's not just a blanket agreement or disagreement with the majority.
Uh-huh.
It's a nuanced analysis of where different powers lie within the Constitution.
This is why we deep dive, folks.
I agree.
We're getting into the nitty-gritty of how our government works.
That's right.
Now we can't forget about Chief Justice Roberts and Justice Scalia.
Of course not.
Who were pretty vocal in their dissent.
Yes, they were.
They weren't just disagreeing with the majority's interpretation.
Right.
They were sounding the alarm about the potential implications
yeah.
for the balance of power.
They were definitely concerned their dissent wasn't just about a passport.
Mm-hmm.
It was a broader critique of the court giving the president too much power in foreign affairs.
It sounds like they saw this case as part of a larger trend.
Mm-hmm.
A potential shift in power towards the executive branch.
Yes.
Were they worried about setting a dangerous precedent for future cases?
Absolutely. They argued that the majority opinion tipped the scales too far in favor of the president.
Okay.
And that this could have a ripple effect, weakening Congress's role in foreign policy.
Mm-hmm.
They believed that Congress and the president should share power in this area.
Uh-huh.
And they saw this ruling as a step in the wrong direction.
So even with a clear majority ruling.
Right.
There's this underlying tension, this concern about how much power any one branch of government should have.
Exactly.
It's a constant balancing act, isn't it?
It is. And that's what makes this case so relevant.
Mm-hmm.
Even for those of us who aren't constitutional law experts.
Right.
It highlights the importance of checks and balances
mm-hmm.
and the ongoing debate about how power is shared and exercised within our government.
We've covered a lot of ground here exploring the ins and outs of the Zivotofsky case, the Supreme Court's decision, and the different perspectives offered in the dissenting opinions.
Right.
But I have a feeling there's even more to unpack.
Oh, definitely.
What other questions should we be asking ourselves
sure.
as we think about this case and its implications?
That's a great question. The Zivotofsky case, while focusing on a very specific issue,
mm-hmm.
opens up a broader discussion about the tools Congress has to influence foreign policy.
Okay.
Even when they can't directly control recognition.
Mm.
If they can't dictate what's printed on a passport,
yeah.
what other options do they have?
Ooh, that's a good one. It's like Congress has to come up with a whole new playbook
yeah.
for dealing with the president on the world stage.
Exactly.
What are some of those alternative strategies? We'll delve into those fascinating questions in part 3 of our deep dive. So stick with us. Welcome back, deep divers. We've been talking about the Zivotofsky v. Kerry case,
right?
Where the Supreme Court sided with the president on recognizing foreign countries.
Mm-hmm.
But as we learned from those dissenting opinions, Congress isn't totally powerless.
Not at all.
They still have some options
yeah.
when it comes to influencing foreign policy.
Exactly. The Zivotofsky case might have settled the passport issue, but it definitely sparked a new conversation
yeah.
about how Congress can make its voice heard on the world stage.
So if they can't just tell the president who to recognize,
right.
what other tools do they have?
Well, one of their most powerful weapons is the power of the purse. They control the budget, which means they can basically fund or defund anything related to U.S. involvement abroad.
Ah, the classic follow the money strategy.
Right.
So even if they can't force the president to recognize a particular country,
mm-hmm.
they can make it a lot harder.
Absolutely.
Or a lot easier, depending on how they allocate those funds.
Exactly. Think about it. Embassies,
yeah.
foreign aid, military operations.
Yeah.
All of that requires congressional approval.
That's a lot of leverage.
It is.
So they can get pretty creative with those financial powers.
Oh, absolutely.
To try to nudge foreign policy in a certain direction.
Exactly. They can use those tools to either support or undermine the president's foreign policy goals.
Interesting.
It all depends on their priorities and whether they agree with the president's approach.
Now, what about the big one?
Which one?
The power to declare war.
Ah, yes. That's a major check on the president's power.
Because even if the president wants to send troops somewhere,
mm-hmm.
Congress can step in and say, hold on, we need to debate this first, and we might not give you the authorization.
Exactly. Only Congress has the power to officially declare war.
Wow.
So that gives them a big say in whether the U.S. engages in military action overseas.
It's fascinating to see all these checks and balances in action.
It is.
How these different branches are constantly pushing and pulling,
right,
debating, and ultimately finding a way to move forward.
It's a dynamic system for sure.
Well, this deep dive has given us so much to think about.
I agree.
From the specifics of the Zivotofsky case,
mm-hmm,
to the bigger questions about how our government handles foreign policy.
It's a complex issue, but hopefully this conversation has shed some light on it.
It definitely has. And as always, we encourage you to explore the sources further and keep those conversations going.
Absolutely. There's always more to learn.
Thanks for joining us on this fascinating journey into the world of passports, presidential power, and the ever-evolving landscape of foreign policy.
It's been my pleasure.
Until next time, keep exploring. Keep questioning and keep diving deep.